My talk today is going to be about sign structure of quantum state. It's not strictly related to machine learning. I'd say it's more machine learning inspired into some of the ideas and definitely enabled by machine learning software. And so we're going to look at sign structure. And what the sign structure is simply is the appearance of negative amplitudes in a quantum state, say a wave function, for example. Or better, the presence of amplitudes with both positive and negative signs. And this is something quite fundamental, right? It underlies a whole range of quantum phenomena, like quantum interference, which is at the base of many quantum algorithms for digital quantum processors. It's important in condensed matter, as you know, we know that the electrons, wave function of electrons, they have a sign structure because of the Pauli principle, and it's important for classical simulation in the context of quantum Monte Carlo, and I'm going to say something more about that. So some of the questions that I'm thinking about is, you know, how to classify the complexity of a sign structure, and what is even the complexity of a sign structure, right? And how does the sign structure contribute to the complexity of representing quantum state through classical resources? How to get rid of a sign structure, like when we map positive and negative wave function into a fully positive form? And when can we not do that? So when is this sign structure intrinsic? So it cannot be removed, I say efficiently, and I'm still going to be vague about this. And finally, you know, what is the relationship between sign structure and entanglement? And what are the consequences for quantum Monte Carlo? In practice, I'm not going to really answer any of those questions, but I just want to raise them and, you know, just present a tool that might help us actually answer this at some point. I think those are all very, very, very interesting questions. And so this work was done in collaboration with Juan and Roger, which are here, and Matthew Fishman is a Flatiron, is currently lead developer of iTensor. And Matthew Fishing UCSB. And you know, personally, I've been thinking about this problem for quite a while, but we had all the different pieces, and kind of everything came together during the program at KITP this winter, so it was very exciting. And so I want to start with kind of the context where I started thinking about sign structure, which is quantum Monte Carlo. And so, as most of you know, It is possible when we have a quantum anybody system at thermal equilibrium, it's possible to represent a partition function of the system in imaginary time as a path integral. So we have this quantum object, and we have these particles moving around maybe, and then we represent the partition function in D plus one, where we obtain these classical-like strings, right? And as you see, the partition function can be written as a sum of these weights, and if the path integral is positive, which just means that all these transition elements between each time slice are positive always, then all these weights are also positive. So essentially, we find again a partition function of a classical Stathmite model, right? And so this is very, very important if you want to simulate the system using classical Monte Carlo, so quantum in the sense that, you know, we have a D plus one representation of a quantum system. And then you can compute average value of observable just as you would do in a classical simulation where, you know, you sample these word lines according to some distribution, essentially. And so there is a catch, of course. The catch is that this condition often it's not respected. And so what you end up is that you have a sign structure, that's what we can call in the weights. And you can always say, you know, sample nonetheless, and that's the equivalent of sampling the absolute value of this weight. But what's happening here, essentially, you're pushing these signs into the estimator. So when you compute the average value of some observable, you have to reweight by the sign. And this is the catch, because in fact, the signal-to-noise ratio of the sign just is exponentially small in both the system size and the inverse temperature. So what this means is that if you do QMC in some sign problematic case, you end up with something like this. As you cool down the system, your result of your simulation just become polluted by the signs. And so this is the sign problem in quantum Monte Carlo. And so in general, we have these two philosophy. Well, it's true that the general solution, you know, is MP hard, and But you know, on the other hand, we can look for specific solutions to for specific problems, or you know, we can also try to alleviate the sine problem, meaning that we try to increase the average sine. So it's still exponential, but if you increase the average sine, means that you can push your simulation to lower temperature, or you know, in the other way, you can study larger and larger systems. Okay. So I find myself here in this more positive side of the slide, and here are some other examples: Meron cluster, fermion bags, and you know, there have been some extensive work on this case. And a general procedure would be to find the basis where the sine problem is less severe, and I'm gonna talk about that a little bit more. But so this is kind of the context where I start thinking about sine structure, but I don't want to really stick out with the sine problem of quantum Monte Carlo. I want to think about a sine problem as not directly related to the algorithm per se, but more like as the impossibility of capturing some quantum physics in terms of a purely classical framework, okay, like a StatMech framework. And so in this context, that we can think about the path integrals and the finite temperature, but we can also think about simply the ground state. So we just take a limit of very very large inverse temperature, and we work with a pure state, like a wave function. So we can pick a reference basis in our many-body Hilbert space, and we can expand the wave function in this basis, and we have all these coefficients. So now the sine structure in this case is simply given by the sines of all this amplitude in this basis. Okay. So, and then again, we can have a situation where all these coefficients are positive or all negative. Again, they have to be they have to have the same sign. And in this case, the average sign is equal to 1. And we can say there is no sine structure here. And similar to the path integrals, we have kind of this notion of classical interpretation, meaning that if all these coefficients are positive, then there is a one-to-one correspondence between the wave function and a classical probability distribution. This is just formulated by the Born rule of probabilities, okay? But if this is not the case, then in general we have this sine structure, which might look something like this. We have all the possible states in the Hilbert space, we have our wave function, and you can see you have positive and negative amplitudes, right? And again, we choose a basis, and in this basis the wave function has a sine structure. Clearly, this is a basis-dependent statement. Okay, so the question is, can we discover a basis where this sign, this wave function, becomes all positive? Okay. And so this is formalized fairly simply. You're just looking for a unitary transformation that changes the state into a positive form. Now the rotated state is all positive. And now I'm gonna keep this diagrammatic notation is gonna be helpful later. And so we can, in general, imagine we have a wave function in this blob, and we want to obtain a new wave function just by applying this unitary transformation. And it's convenient to express this unitary as a quantum circuit and compile it in local gates. And this will help us define broadly what complexity means in this case. So the question is, given a certain wave function, is there one of these unitary transformations that maps you into a positive state, right? And the answer is yes. There is always one. Is the essentially the energy eigenbasis in this basis. The wave function is always positive. Okay, but again, there is a catch here too, because finding this basis would be equivalent to diagonalization. So it's as hard as diagonalizing the full problem. So the question is rather not is there a basis where the wave function becomes positive, but is in general, but when this is easier than solving the full problem. And again, in this case, compiling the unitary as a set of local gates, we will obtain a circuit which very, very large depth, generally, if you have a very non-local transformation. Okay? And so the question is where it is easier than this, and we know at least one answer, which is quantum antiferromagnets in bipartite lattice. And in this case, we know that the ground state for these models, they respect the Marshall pair sine rule. So it means that we know what is the sine of the wave function. It's just given this is the number of upspin in one of the sublattices. And we know what's the circuit that removes the sine structure. Okay. So in this case, It's just it's like a single qubit rotation of pi around the z-axis for sites only in one of the two sublattices, okay? So this is one case where, you know, we can see this is easy in the sense that the circuit has a constant depth, depth one. If you increase the size of the system, the circuit that removes the sign structure remains of depth one, right? Yes. What about the general case, right? What if we don't have this insight and we just look at this and we could say, well, is this apparent in the sense that it's like trivially removed by the depth one circuit or something like that? Or is it intrinsic, meaning that removing is as hard as finding this basis of the energy eigenbasis, right? And so again, we know that there is always a unitary transformation then apply to a positive state, give us this unknown quantum state. But the question is, how complex is this sign structure? You could compute the average sign here, and you would get something like this, 0.045. It's very small, right? So you could, you know, try to use this to infer how complicated or complex is this sign structure, but this would be like a good idea. And I mean, the point that I'm trying to make here is, how would we even know if this transformation exists, and which is it? And the point here is this is just the Ising, the wave function of a 1D Ising model, just with one single, that one single qubit gate. So if we just look at this, it's really hard to know how, you know, how far away we are from a positive state if we don't have any insights in the problem, okay? So the strategy here is kind of to do this in an automated way, so find and do an autonomous search over the space of unitary transformation, which essentially define local bases that positivize our wave functions, okay? And this is kind of where machine learning came into play, kind of as a philosophy, and what I learned in the last 3 or 4 years is that if we have an appropriate representation of a problem, and we find a good or a clever cost function, and then we leverage a good software, then, you know, this goes a long way often. And so usually in machine learning, the appropriate representation is given by neural network. We map the variable into these networks of neurons, but it's not necessary. We don't have to limit to that. And in this case, the representation would be given by tensor networks instead. But the software part and the good cost function, essentially, it's what we usually do in machine learning, or, you know, if you will, in an optimization framework. Okay, so I'm going to go through these three ingredients. The first one is tensor network representation. So we have to make an assumption on the input state. So far, I just draw blobs, but this is clearly not scalable. And so we make the assumption that the input state that we are trying to positivize is as a matrix product state representation. So we can write it as this. And, you know, the coefficients are just obtained by projecting the MPS into these classical states, and this can all be done efficiently, right? Same thing for the quantum circuit. We can parameterize it as a set of local gates with some parameters, and well, this is already shown before. We have this unitary transformation is just compiled into these gates, which can again be represented as simple tensors. Next is the cost function, and so. Again, our goal is that we want to make the average sign equal to 1. Okay, so for each or minus 1, let's assume we have an initial positive sign going towards that. We can always gauge that with a global rotation. So we want that for each state of the Hilbert space, the sign of the wave function is equal to 1. But, you know, now we are applying a quantum circuit to our state, so if we use a universal set of gates, we're going to pick up complex phases. Okay, so yes, we need the sign of the real part to be 1, but we also need the imaginary part to be 0. Otherwise, we just created more mess. So if you use gates that are real, you're not really using a universal gate set, so you wouldn't know if you didn't find the unitary because you're just not expressive enough. But so you know we use all the gates, so we are allowing the state during the circuit to just span a larger space, but then we need to bring it back and cancel these complex phases by the end of the circuit. And so, okay, this condition can be expressed as averages over this distribution, so the average absolute value of the imaginary part and the average sign of the real part. And these are not, you know, quantity that we can compute with tensor contractions. They're not like, can be brought into a matrix product operator form. So we just keep them as average for now. We're going to sample later. And so the cost function that we are defining is the average over the output distribution of this state, of this quantity, of this convex sum of these two conditions. So if you want to minimize this, essentially we are requiring that this to be minimum, so zero, and this to be maximum, so one. And we are going to try to do them simultaneously. And then, well, just the usual, we solve this by iteratively changing this parameter according to the gradients. So we're going to need to compute the gradients too. And again, as I said, there is no MPO representation, but we give them this distribution at the output of the circuit. We know how to draw samples from it. This can be done efficiently with matrix product states, and also like it's also perfect sampling, so we don't have autocorrelation. And this is just a draw. So if you have a pure state, you build a density matrix, and these are all tensor contraction you can do efficiently. So in fact, we are approximating our cost function instead of a full sum over all the Hilbert space as just a sum over finite number of samples, which are drawn from the correct distribution of the matrix product state. And the last bit is the, well, it's how to take the gradient, right? And so we use automatic differentiation, just borrowed from machine learning. And I'm not going to go through much details. I think like Lei on Friday is going to cover more about this. But the philosophy is that you build a computational graph, essentially, where you have some parameters that you want to tune, and you have some output, which is the cost function. And you first do a forward pass, where you compute all the intermediate steps, and you save all the results. And then you compute the derivatives in this reverse accumulation mode by backpropagating through the graph starting from the output. So you use the chain rule and Jacobian vector products. And you have the value of in these nodes of the derivatives because you already did the forward pass. And so that's how automatic differentiation works. So the point is that everything in your graph needs to be differentiable, and you need to have the correct derivatives, correct primitives in your software. So you need to know what the derivative is of, you know, SVD or QR decomposition and so on. And so I'll just show the full graph. And here is the cost function. It's the sum of this sample-wise cost function drawn from the output state by perfect sampling. So in practice, we start with a circuit of some parameter theta and some input state. And the first thing, you contract the whole circuit to obtain an output state. Then you can use the output state to sample from it. Those are just sample from this probability distribution. This doesn't have to be in the graph. Actually, it's not, because there are no branches going through anything. And once you have this sample, then you can use your output state and project into each one of these classical states to obtain the wave function. And then use the wave function to compute the cost function, which was this imaginary this thing here. And once you have that, you sum them all up, and you obtain your cost function, your final cost function. Okay. And so I'm just going to quickly go through an example. If you imagine having a circuit which is just a single, one 2-qubit gate, then your first step in obtaining this, you apply the circuit, you apply the gate to these two sides, and you SVD to bring it back to MPS. This is looks something like this. Once you have the MPS after the SVD, so here, you can use it to sample all these classical states. And then the projection into this classical state, again, is just tensor contraction, so that can do. They're all differentiable. And then this just means you take the absolute value of the imaginary part, the sign of the real part, to obtain the cost function. So this is to say that, you know, all these operations, they're all differentiable. You can take derivatives, and we know the primitives. And so this is the forward pass, and, you know, we obtain the cost function at the end. And now there is the backward pass. And the backward pass essentially backpropagate the derivatives all the way. I didn't draw the rest of the graph, but it's kind of simple. There is only one thing that we need to be careful here is that by approximating the cost function with a sum over sample drawn from a distribution, we are kind of neglecting how this distribution depends on the circuit, right? So we essentially eliminated the P here by doing, and then when you take the gradient, well, we need to compensate for the lack of this of the distribution. And so we just need to add a piece in the graph and be careful not to backpropagate to the wrong branches. But then again, if you take the gradient, you essentially compensate perfectly to this to the lack of distribution due to sampling. Okay, so this is not really a problem, just something to keep in mind. The real problem that crippled the simulation is that there is no stable software for AD and automatic differentiation software that can handle SVD gradients through complex value tensor. And that's because like TensorFlow, they don't really care about complex stuff, apparently. And other newer AD software that were not really stable. So for in this case, we just had to find another way. Right? We tried different things. We tried to map complex number to like 2x2 real matrix algebra. That was unstable because like singular values and so on. Other technique, and what we stick to, it's essentially a 2-qubit gate decomposition, where we, we take the 2-qubit gates and we decompose it as single qubit and C naught, and you can see now the parameters of the circuit, they are only in the single qubit gates, and we can SVD this at the beginning, and these are like bond dimension 2 MPOs. And then during the circuit, we can run the whole circuit without doing ever an SVD at the big price that we cannot truncate the final state. So we can apply all this machinery, but we are not able to truncate. So the bond dimension just grows out of control. So again, we're going to see just a small system. But this, I need to talk to Lei about these two, because apparently they have solved this issue. So I look forward to hear about that. Okay, so there was the algorithm, and we did some numerics, and we considered this model. It's a Heisenberg Hamiltonian on a triangular ladder. We have the usual Heisenberg interaction, the next to nearest neighbor interaction, and then we also have these rings exchange terms on plaquette. And again, here the reference basis, the natural basis that you would choose to study this problem is the ST component of the spins. Okay. And so we start maybe in the limit of J2 and J ring equal to zero. In this case, we have the Heisenberg model, and we know what the circuit is. And so we did a very simple things. We the ansatz of our circuit was just a single qubit rotation around the z-axis. That's exactly what the circuit we are trying to learn is, so just to be sure. And here I'm plotting the angles of this rotation, and we observe that the two sets rotation for different sublattices are colored differently, and we have this, they converge to this value differs from pi, and that's essentially the Marshall sign rule. So that's nice. But again, we really forced the circuit to be the one that was supposed to work. So. And then we can go on the other end, J2 equal to 1, then we observe that the circuit mixes the two different sublattices. I was so excited when I see this, but then I realize shortly after that exactly the Marshall sign rule in the other opposite end, where you have two decoupled Heisenberg chains, so it's not really crazy. And then again, this is assuming that the circuit has this particular form, but then we relax that and we consider generic single qubit rotation, and for all the value of J2s, and this is the ground state sign, this is the Marshall law. There is another Marshall law that I haven't plotted here that goes up, and essentially the circuit, what does, it just, depending which is the strength of the frustrating term, it just picks the best Marshall law it can find, either this one or this one, which it turns out to be the one that actually positivizes the states. And finally, we look at some more complex case, which is related to a Bose metal. Now we turn on J-ring and keep this to zero. The spin chain can be driven into this spin Bose metal phase, and this kind of reminiscent has signatures of this of the Bose metal D-wave Bose liquid in 2D, and the sign structure in this particular model, the Bose liquid, not the spin, is very complex because the model, the theory is obtained by essentially combining two different species of fermions. And so you can imagine like a nodal surfaces of the wave function as tangling up nodal surfaces of two different Fermi surfaces with different structure. So it's very complex, and there is also presence of entanglement. And so we did essentially the same experiment. Now there is not Marshall here. We don't know what the sign rule is. And here is the ground state sign. And we first apply only 1 qubit gates, and we couldn't really pass this this limit here, but then when we turn on the two qubit gates, we could do much, much better. It's not one, but it's much better. And again, we could go on with layers and increase the depth, but we had this truncation issue here. But again, this also tells us that to get closer to one, the entanglement structure needs to be modified. So I'm gonna conclude now, and what I show is, you know, an automated approach to this problem of you know, discovering, or if there is a basis that positivizes every function, and you know, in particular, if this basis can be accessed in an efficient way. Again, efficiency is related to the depth of the circuit that find this basis, and also if the algorithm is, you know, sufficiently powerful to actually find this. And again, this algorithm is based on automatic differentiation of tensor networks. And one of the things that, you know, we really look forward is to have these derivatives for the complex value tensor, and hopefully I know more by the end of the week. And these are some things I'm thinking about now, some direction. And again, the classification of the complexity of the size structure can be related to the depth of the systems of the circuit. So again, if we want to study this in a more systematic way, we should perform this size scaling. So we grow the system size and we look at the depth. Again, when we can truncate, hopefully soon. The other thing is the entanglement. Again, there is some theory about the relation between sign structure and entanglement, and you know, in general, the presence of a sign structure increased entanglement in a quantum state. This was proved by Tarun, which is maybe somewhere here, and Matthew. But the full picture is still kind of lacking, and being able to look at which transformation positivizes the wave function and look at it in terms of quantum circuit, hopefully will give us, you know, some tool to make this connection more rigorous. And finally, of course, I'm still thinking about path integrals, clearly, and how this can be applied to positivize every time slice. And I think, you know, this will be possible in principle. Then other thing if it actually works. And I just want to mention that, you know, while we were writing and we were preparing, other people are actually thinking about very similar ideas. So I suggest you to also check out these other two papers if you're interested. All right, that's it. Thanks.
Giacomo, can you go back to the previous slide with the result? I have one question.
Oh.
Just the last but one. Yeah. So you checked by looking at the average expectation value of the sign, but I was just wondering, did you look into the maximum error? So for example, if you take the largest negative component of your wave function to see how big that is. Because maybe, you know, there's just, you know, maybe there can be like some instability such that one particular component picks up a very large sign, but it's not picked up by the average.
Yeah, no, we didn't look that. That's I mean, you meaning that there is one configuration which is very probable.
Yeah.
But I mean, that shouldn't be the case. I wouldn't expect that, because in the cost function, what we do is we weight sign an imaginary part by the probability that configuration appears. So.
No, I understand. Like, if your tensor network structure, you know, is expressive enough to be able to always go to the minimum, that's the case. But if it's not, then maybe this is kind of, you know, relevant to the larger J-Rink regime. I don't know, like maybe it's going to try to compensate somehow, and then I don't know what's going to happen.
If the tensor network description is not, it cannot capture
cannot
the
capture,
state
yeah,
sufficiently.
Cannot, it does not have like just enough parameters, then it might try to, you know, the cost function might try to find some compromise, and I don't know then.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I haven't explored that. Thanks.
Okay, just a comment. Notation of wave function.
I completely agree. Yeah. So yeah, I didn't mention that. And again, the outlook for the path integrals is something I'm thinking about, but it's exactly right. So unitary transformation that make a wave function positive doesn't necessarily make the path integral positive. So like the pair of Frobenius only goes one way.
And the other one they make.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, but this is not really. Yeah.
If you can.
Yeah, yeah, but this is of course, and again, we need to truncate to explore like a higher number of legs in the ladder. But this is still like fairly non-trivial design structure here, even if it's a quasi 1D, and I think it wouldn't be easy to run like quantum Monte Carlo deep in the Bose metal phase.
Okay, so I had a little question. Is it possible to do it without getting the ground state? I mean, I have the Hamiltonian and I want to do it, but yeah. I do not have the ground state.
Yeah, no, this is seen in the context of path integrals. Essentially, what you would do, you would take the Hamiltonian and then you would plug the unitary circuit on both ends and then try to make that as stochastic as possible.
But not necessary to do it to the whole Hamiltonian, to do it as you're doing also only on the ground state, but I do not have it, I just have the Hamiltonian.
Yeah, yeah, so that's what I mean. I mean, I guess you want to make the Hamiltonian, all the off-diagonal elements of the Hamiltonian positive, or negative, sorry, is that what you mean? So that you don't have to compute the ground state in the first place.
Okay, that's a possible solution. What I was simply saying is that now you have to compute the ground state before proceeding.
Yeah.
But if I give you an Hamiltonian, can you do the same thing without making the Hamiltonian stochastic necessary, just fix the ground state positive without solving?
I don't know. I don't know about that. I would think the easiest thing would be to work with the stochasticity of the Hamiltonian because, that would definitely make the ground state positive.
Yes, that will work sure.
Yeah, you could work with that, but the optimization of the stochasticity is something that we're looking at right now. It's not as well defined as the optimization of the sign of the ground state, just because the way that you do sampling from it. Okay. But that's a very interesting
point. And another question, if you if you are in moving a parameter of your model, does this transformation you find change like crazy, or is it like almost always the same?
If you make a perturbation in the quantum circuit, perturbation of the weight of the of some gates,
if you have your Hamiltonian depends on some parameters, and you're moving the parameters and you're checking how this transformation changes.
I would expect that. That's a good question. I haven't looked at that, but if this change is very small, I would expect transformation shouldn't change too much, but maybe across a phase transition that wouldn't be the case.
One, maybe?
I was wondering about the choice of cost function as well as the hyperparameter gamma there. I imagine that you'd sort of go to different places in parameter space depending on what you choose to minimize. Have you explored how that affects the results?
Can you reformulate? So going to different places of the what?
Did you want me to repeat?
Yeah, please.
Okay. You chose a particular cost function that weighs the imaginary part and the sine of the real part, and there's a parameter gamma that tunes between them. But that's a very specific functional form. Mm-hmm. And also, of course, you have to choose that hyperparameter gamma. Do you have any, how does it work out, say, for tuning that parameter gamma? Do you get a lot of difference, and what results?
If you tune it, if you go in the both end, of course, I usually kept it at 0.5. But of course, that choice would depend on the state you're trying to optimize, whether this imaginary part has a different weight or not. But in general, for all the simulation that I did, and I fixed it to 0.5, and it was fairly similar to a range around that. And of course, if you go too large, it definitely changes. And usually the does not improve, actually.